shoot my band. Band. Shoot my band. I don't want to shoot my band. As Mr. Michael Dean from Freedom Fiends, I am the Iron Hamster. We are talking to Lusander Fiend, the Chop Shop Rooster. Are you there, sir?
I am. I am here, my brother.
Have you been contacted by the government?
No, not that I paid attention to.
And we have Nick Hazelton, the Hazy Yak. Are you there, sir?
I am here.
You got some bacon seeds?
I do.
We're going to talk about bacon seeds, but I have to do the intro. This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus ceruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This keeps a sin flood of statism out of your brain. Can you feel it? Is it working, guys? Can you feel it?
I feel it.
Cool.
I feel it, bro.
And Nick is our friend who comes to us from... Well, I was going to say via public school, but no, he's involved with us without public school, but he is getting high school credit for staying up late. Is it a school night? I don't even know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So does that mean like you can actually sleep through your first period class and say, I was on the radio till 3 a.m., man?
Yeah, I've got a study hall on Thursdays right in the beginning.
Cool. Cool. As long as you don't snore, you can take a nap or not.
Yeah.
They don't make you study.
No.
So, yeah, Nick's in, 10th grade, 11th grade?
10th.
Yep, and you get school credit for being on the radical, the radical capitalist radio show called The Freedom Fiends. And I kind of like that, radical capitalist. That sounds just wrong to so many people, but I think it would describe us. We're mellow and radical. We're radically capitalist. We think you should be able to keep all your money and all your bacon seeds. Did you come up with that term, Lou?
No, I didn't, but I certainly homesteaded it.
What, Nick, what is a bacon seed?
A bacon seed is a piglet.
How many piglets you have?
I have four.
Yeah? Tell me about piglet ownership.
Yeah, so I've got four little baby American guinea hogs. These are not the first piglets I've raised, but I bought them from one of my neighbors, and he raises them. Eventually, I'm going to sell them for meat, but they're probably 10 pounds. I bet they're lighter than 10 pounds. They're just cute and adorable little black, kind of hairy.
Aren't they like as smart as dogs or smarter?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah.
I'll argue with that. Dogs don't turn into bacon.
No, I think it's a social thing, and I'm not saying let's eat dogs instead, but what makes it okay to eat one animal and not another? And, the rules change in a zombie apocalypse. I've been watching Walking Dead. Are you a fan, Nick?
Not really. I've seen a few.
Are you old enough to watch it?
Yeah.
Okay.
My sister and my mom watch it, but I don't.
Do they really? Did you tell them that Freedom Fiends is going to quit being a libertarian show and turn into a full-time Walking Dead fan podcast?
I haven't yet, but I will.
It's not really going to, but next week, Davi and I are doing three nights in a row, one of the nights with Chandler, and it's going to be all zombies all the time. So, yeah, the rules change in a zombie apocalypse. So tell me more about pig ownership.
It's fairly easy if you can keep them in the pen. Right now, these guys aren't big enough to lift up any hog panel, so they can't get out. And they have tried, but they're definitely not strong enough. But the other pigs I have, currently four are out in another field, and they have not been haven't had their recent security checks.
You mean they're missing?
They are not missing. I know where they're at, but they have not been present where I'd like them to be.
A longer pig if you can keep it, man. No, not long pig. Long pig is a World War I term for human meat. That's kind of gross.
Yeah, in Michigan, your pigs would be considered feral and the DNR would come out and plug them for them not being locked up like they're supposed to be.
Yeah, explain the assault pig idea for those listeners who haven't heard it, Lou.
Oh, Michigan DNR got this brilliant idea.
What's DNR? That's fish and hogs, right?
Department of Natural Resources or Do Nothing Right, Department of Fish and Hogs, Department of Chickens and Goats and whatever. But anyhow, they got this wild idea that there's this big giant feral hog problem here. And there's like, I don't know, been maybe like 3 sightings that were reported by a friend of a friend who knew somebody who had heard about somebody seeing one of these things, possibly. And anyway, they decided that feral pigs would be made illegal, and they outlawed them based upon the breed and not the activity. So they decided that these little characteristics, like, you know, being furry or having a curly tail or a straight tail, floppy ears or erect ears, were the telltale signs of a feral pig.
And this was based on pressure from lobbyists and backdoor deals in the pig industrial complex, right?
Well, I have no actual evidence of it, but if you follow all government regulation, I'd say it's probably a 100% safe bet.
I read somewhere that the you know, big meat farms and meat processing companies there had something to do with that law being passed.
Well, I know that they got behind it. I don't know that they wrote it and paid for it. I wouldn't be surprised if they did.
Yeah. And you know, personally, know farmers who've had their pigs murdered or taken away, right?
I don't know ones that have had them murdered or taken away, but I know one guy who stood up to them.
And what was the result? What did he do and what was the result?
The result is, well, it was typical of the justice system. If you keep putting money in long enough, you know, maybe it'll work out for you. Maybe it won't. In his case, it semi sort of worked out because he had to sue for a clarification of the rule. And when you have to sue to get a clarification of the rules that you're supposed to follow, what does that say about the rules? But anyway, the state, I don't know, he's not the attorney general, but some statocrat basically requested a dismissal, and he said, oh, no, we have no problem with Mark's pigs right now. So, you know, we're going to ask that you dismiss it.
They're probably just waiting until it blows over and coming back because, you know, in a lot of cases, the state can just come back whenever they want, and they don't have to hire an attorney. I mean, they have all the attorneys they need, and you pay for them.
Right, right.
With your bacon tax.
Yeah, this is an actual statocrat, so it's not like they hired this guy off the street to handle this job.
Yeah.
But, incidentally, the little documentary about it is out. It's called Hogwash, An American Pig Tale.
Mm-hmm. Nick, weren't you thinking of making some kind of documentary about farming?
Yeah, one of the fans of Anyak and Freedom Fiends was he gave me the idea of Yaks and Hogs, The Road to Independence.
That was me.
Kinda,
wasn't it?
I said that name. Yeah.
I hooked you up with that guy in Texas that used to be the sound man for the Beehole Surfers, who now is a goat cheese farmer.
Yeah, Christian Seeger.
Yeah, Christian. Yep. So how's that coming? Still in the planning stage?
Yeah, completely. Cool. I haven't had too much time to think of. Well, I have had time, but I don't take the time to think about it.
Lou, what's the name of that documentary again? I'm going to link that.
Hogwash, An American Pig Tale. I know it's on Vimeo. I'm not sure if it's on YouTube, though.
All right.
Seems like it would be.
Who made it?
I don't know who the filmmakers were.
Excellent. I like the name.
Yeah. You know, I'm kind of bummed out, though.
Why?
And I'm jumping off the subject here.
Share your feels with me.
Another deer season has come and gone, and I struck out.
You know, I didn't go deer hunting, and I had the same results as you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my automobiles have killed more deer than my guns have.
Did you hit a deer this year?
No, that was last year.
That's a takeoff on a bumper sticker about Ted Kennedy. Ted Kennedy's car has killed more people than my guns.
Yeah. So Ted Kennedy should be very happy with my hunting results.
Yeah. Ted Kennedy's, isn't he a zombie now?
I think he always was.
Too soon?
He probably drinks a little less alcohol now.
You think?
Not much, but.
You think his butler goes out every month and pours a 40 of Cavassier on his grave?
It's probably like a 55-gallon drum of cheap vodka.
Yeah, it's probably very expensive wine, actually, but. Yeah. So you got any more, Nick, on piglets?
No, it's fun to raise them, I guess. That's all I got.
So your website, your podcast is the Anarcho Yakutalist Podcast, and it's at an-yak.com. That's an-yak.com. And people should check that out, because this guy, Nick, is the next generation. He's hanging out with us, and we're a bad influence, and we're teaching him how to do podcasting and radio really, really well. And, man, I can't imagine if I'd had podcasting when I was 16. I'd probably be in prison, but I'm kidding. But, you know, when I was 16, it's like, if I wanted to talk to the world, what did I do? Well, when I was 17, I went to community college and majored in communication and then dropped out. So that didn't really help. That was like my only option, or like actually writing letters to the editor. I used to write, when I was 19, I wrote a column for a local entertainment paper. It was called like the, I don't know, the Something Weekly. It was like the, you know, the thing that listed all the cover metal bands that were playing around the county. And, I had an unpaid job. It was my first writing gig. An unpaid job writing a weekly. I got 4 column inches of space, and I would write whatever I was thinking about. And one week, I didn't have an idea, and it was deadline. And it was like an hour till deadline, and I had this idea. This is when Reagan was president, and I called up the editor and said, just print this. Print the title, What I Like About Ronald Reagan by Michael W. Dean, and then print 4 inches of blank space. And, and they did, and my, I got like almost a death threat from this DJ, morning drive show guy who like wrote a letter calling me a drugged out little space cadet, and he signed his name and then his station name, and he almost got fired for it, and my dad made a big stink and threatened to sue him. It was pretty funny. And he did a retraction that didn't seem very sincere. Worms.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Freedom Fiends. So, Nick, tell us more about bacon seeds, baby piglets.
Well, yeah. So I have quite a bit of hogs. Yeah. On Monday I had 12, and now I have 10. I finally sold a pig, and my dad owned one of the other pigs, so we're eating that one.
Wow. How big were they when you had them slaughtered? How heavy?
These guys are a smaller breed. And these ones were not fed very well when they were younger. I did not feed them, and they would have been well fed if I had raised them, but I bought them. So these guys were probably about 60 pounds when slaughtered, and my guess is that they hung about 25 pounds each, which is really, really small.
Are they tastier if they're smaller or bigger, or does it make a difference?
Usually if they're bigger, they taste better, more fat. the fatter they are, the better they taste.
That makes a flavor.
Yeah, yeah. Are a lot of your classmates also farmers, or do they think you're weird?
There's a few people. We're a pretty rural school. Most of the kids come from town, but there's like 3 other kids that have animals.
Cool, cool. Do you talk about your libertarian politics, your ideas of, government should be so small that it's theorized about by particle physicists? Do you talk about that stuff with kids at school?
Yeah, pretty much whenever I had the chance in class. I found the ways that you can trace almost every problem back to government.
I would have gotten beat up in school for that when I went to school, literally.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the principal's kid, so they can't beat you up.
Nice.
Now, a lot of them actually really dig it. It's hard to disagree with libertarian philosophy when you get it down to the basics.
Yeah, but occasionally you run into people who reject.
What about the roads?
Yeah, or just like, I mean, I've even heard, you know, when you break it down to like all laws are backed by the barrel of a gun, you know, I've heard kids, generally statists will deny that or try to, you know, flirt around it or ignore it. But I've even heard some lately, they're like, yeah, damn straight, and that's how it should be, because people are stupid, and they need to have the gun pointed at their head by the state to make them be good, you know? You ever run into that?
Oh, yeah. I get that sort of stuff all the time. But, you know, the thing that I do is I get it down. I find where people really care about something. And, yeah. You know, you hit it hard there. And
yeah. Everyone's got their single issue.
Right.
You know, which is why it was the basis of my movie Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom at gunsandweed.com. You know, was the idea, it's based on an idea from the 70s from this writer named Robert Anton Wilson, who created something. It was a joke. He said he wanted to create the Guns and Dope Party. And the idea was that if all the gun owners in California and all the weed smokers in California started a political party, they'd have like 85% of the vote and could do anything they wanted.
That's not a good thing either.
Yeah. Yeah.
They might agree on their guns and weed, but they'll find something else to freak out over.
They'd probably make it illegal to not have guns or weed.
No, they'd probably be like, we need government paid for guns and weed.
There you go. That's what it would be. You need weed stamps and gun stamps along with the food stamps. Yeah. So, Nick, tell me about some of the arguments that you have or discussions you have with people who are not down with freedom and how you approach it and what the results are.
I think that the most recent one I can think of is we were talking about child protection services. And
which actually generally does more harm than good.
Right, and that's what we discussed, and there was nobody who was willing to deny that. We all kind of agreed, and I'm like, yeah, see, now you understand why I don't like the government.
That one's a tough question, though. You know, what about protection of children in the lack of a government? And, you know, I really shy away from those how many angels could dance on the head of a pin, libertarian pin kind of stuff, because I'm not the central planner of liberty, and I really think that things would be taken care of. I hate sounding like the market would take care of it, which sounds like magical fairy dust would take care of it. You know, it's not really much of an explanation, but the market is people, and people will find a way to take care of things without the government and generally do a better job cheaper without the coercion.
Well, if people could say the government will take care of it, I don't see why people get laughed at when they say the market will take care of it.
That's a really good point, man. Because saying the government will take care of it is almost like saying magic fairies with machine guns pointed at you will take care of it.
Riding unicorns.
Yes. Of democracy. We'll be back after this trip to the free and capitalist market, the radical capitalist market. I like that term. That's my new term.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Freedom Fiends. Hogwash. The American Pigtail. I was looking at the trailer for this movie and the website, which is AmericanHogwash.org. And I said to Lou, yeah, look at this picture. It's great. It's got a pig with an American flag behind it and a grumpy looking farmer. And what did you say?
I said, oh, that's Mark.
He said he is kind of grumpy. Yeah.
But he does laugh and joke around too. So
good, good. He's kind of an unlikely hero. Like he's become kind of a, you know, not a media darling, but, you know, a lot of cameras and microphones pointed at him in the past couple of years. How does he feel about that?
My personal opinion, had none of this ever happened and he just went about raising his animals and going about his business, he would have been a heck of a lot happier.
Yeah.
Best way to describe him is he has that gruff farmer or rancher way about him.
Yeah, and I asked you how big is his farm and what'd you say?
That's about 80 acres.
No, you said it's huge. It's about 80 acres. And I said, that's not huge, man. I'm from Wyoming. That's someone's front yard here. I mean, literally, there are ranches in the state of Wyoming, single ranches that are bigger than the state of Delaware. Yeah, but a lot of them are cows and sheep, not pigs. And cows and sheep need a lot more land because they graze.
What about buffalo? There's buffalo ranches out there too, right?
Yeah. Beefalo. And there's also like preserves where buffalo are not eaten. They're just raised. And there's also Yellowstone, which is, you know, a natural habitat that's kind of a government protected area with I think I read somewhere that Yellowstone has the most diverse population of mammals of anywhere in America. It's pretty awesome. You ever been?
Not yet. I hear they raise geysers there too.
Yeah, they do. It's
they plant them in the ground and they grow them.
No, they come from there. I like that movie, the one like that end of the world movie where LA
2012.
Yeah, yeah, the one with
Jack Cusack.
Yeah, yeah, and Woody Harrelson is the crazy pirate radio guy doing the conspiracy show from his mobile command van.
His bad Quaker mobile.
He kind of reminds me of Bad Quaker. He's like Bad Quaker crossed with the yeah. So he goes to Yellowstone, and there's like all these Cusack gets caught by all these army dudes with machine guns, and he's like, "What are you guys doing out here?" And he's like, "We're doing geology." And he's like, "Do you always do geology with machine guns?" And I'm like, "It's the government. Of course they do geology with machine guns."
They do everything with machine guns.
They really do. Yeah. So speaking of the government's bad and does everything with guns, what did you want to talk about grand juries?
Nick?
Was that me? Oh, no. Bad radio. Well, what a grand jury is the, I guess it's pretty much a pre-jury, and they decide whether there's a case to be had and whether it goes to an actual trial.
Yeah.
And it's kind of an interesting thing. I don't quite understand why, but I guess there is some purpose to them on whether we should actually go through and have a trial. But it seems like we could just have a trial, right?
Yeah, but a lot of times something that's originally tried with – the grand jury thing actually goes back to the Constitution, I believe. And it's – I'm going to check that before I settle on that.
It's the Fifth Amendment, yeah. It calls for there must be a grand jury, and it's has okay. a history into, I think, England is mainly where it comes from yeah. Common law.
What it's evolved into now, though, is very often when something goes to a grand jury and they decide it should go to, you know, for an indictment, and they take it to a jury, that's prejudicial on the eventual jury that tries it. They're like, well, it must, you know, they must be guilty because they got a jury said they were already. And the thing about grand juries is that they are generally entirely composed of old people. And I'm not saying that in any bad way. It's just a matter of fact, because grand jurors are impaneled for 6 to 9 months, and people who aren't retired can't, you know, work for $5 a day full time for 6 to 9 months, and retired people can. And a lot of times people who are on the grand juries want to be impaneled for 6 or 9 months because it gives them something to do, and they're really excited to be a part of the process. And a lot of times older people that want to do that are people who are easily influenced by a prosecutor. They have, you know, like suddenly they have some power, they get to punish somebody. And whether or not it's a, you know, a real crime or not, you know, if it's something with no victim, even so, like they'll be like, yeah, let's throw the book at him, kind of feeling. I mean, they don't actually.
People who show up for that are generally really, really, really statist.
Yeah. 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 To want to work for the state for $5 a day, you know, or $10 a day for nearly a year, you'd have to really love the state, I think. And I was kind of being callous when I said they want to throw the book at him. It's not like the grand jury, you know, determines the sentence. They just determine whether there's an indictment or not. But there's an extraordinarily high indictment rate with, I don't know what it is with state juries, but with grand juries, but with federal, it's something like, you know, a fraction of 1% of the time they don't return an indictment.
In the past 3 years, I think I think it was like the year 2009, 2010, and going by fiscal year, federal grand juries returned indictments in all but 11 cases.
Yeah, they basically are a show trial.
Yeah,
and they're often used when there's, you know, a policeman shoots somebody, and you know, people are calling for blood, and they say we must have justice. You know, instead of just doing what they usually do, which is giving the cop 2 weeks of paid vacation for shooting somebody, they'll have a grand jury trial, and it's basically a show trial. And I want to pitch it back to Lou here, but I want to talk about the history of show trials, especially in Nazi Germany.
Okay, let's do a little theory versus reality. As you guys mentioned, the theory behind the grand jury is that it's a way to test the waters. The prosecutor goes in there with his evidence, and he presents it. And if you can get, and these vary by state to state, if you can get a certain number of people to say, you know what, yeah, I think this is worthy of going to trial, then they go forward. What it generally is in practice and real life, everything else, it's basically a rubber stamp for the prosecutor. So when we look at, for example, the grand jury for Eric Garner and the grand jury for Michael Brown out in Ferguson, essentially what happens is the prosecutor goes in there. He controls the proceedings. He doesn't have a judge to tell him what he can and can't do. He presents all the evidence to the grand jurors without challenge, without cross-examination. And for some reason, I don't know why, but whenever there's a cop on there, they're just not able to get an indictment against their coworker.
Yeah. So the show trial concept, it goes back before Nazi Germany, but there was a show trial system created by Adolf Hitler, which was called Sonderrecht, or special court, this is pretty funny. You know what the name for the court was, like the translation of it and what it was called in general, was the People's Court.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, it's funny that there's a show called People's Court. You know, it's one of those fake laws where you know, people who don't have jobs sit around the afternoon and watch some ex-judge lady, you know, scream at people and tell them to do the right thing, the People's Court. But it was a special court established in 1934 by German Chancellor Adolf Hitler, who had been dissatisfied with the outcome of the Reichstag fire. All but one of the accused were acquitted. So the People's Court was set up outside of the operations of the constitutional frame of law. The court had jurisdiction over a rather broad array of political offenses, which included crimes like black marketeering, work slowdowns, defeatism, and treason against the Third Reich. Defeatism, is that like accepting defeat without a struggle? It's basically pessimism. Yeah,
yeah.
A crime of pessimism.
Bad morale.
Yeah, yeah. We would be murdered in Nazi Germany. I mean, we wouldn't have been able to do this on radio, but, you know, if we'd been doing this, you know, as pamphlets, which is probably what people were doing, we would have been murdered. We would have been tried in the People's Court and murdered. And, you know, it may be getting to that in America, but hopefully not yet. And I do want to say, if anybody thinks that we're a bad influence on a minor having a 16-year-old on our show and training him to do this kind of stuff, we have his parents' permission. I've talked with his parents and we've talked to his school, and they're involved in this.
and you even do paperwork for the school for him to get a paper grade.
Yeah, there's probably people saying, you're not a good no government man because you are participating with the state schools. Hey man, I'll do it. I'll do it to help Nick.
You probably drive on the roads too.
I do. I don't build my own. Yeah. I don't violate the monopoly by going out and laying blacktop parallel to the public roads and drive on that instead. I just, I have a blimp anyway.
Someone asked me, well, why do you drive on the government roads? Well, simple, because they'll shoot me if I drive on the grass.
Okay. Back to the People's Court. I mean, grand juries.
And you know what? There's a lot of status here that would say, oh, it's not the government's court. It's the people's court. And now when you hear that, you can just think back to what you learned on the Freedom Fiends.
Yeah.
But yeah, the grand jury, it's a really interesting case. And I contacted the Freedom Fiends legal correspondent to find out, because I was really concerned about the Ferguson grand jury. And part of the reason for that is Officer Wilson was allowed to go in there and testify for 4 hours. And I haven't read all the transcripts because they did like a 2,000-page document dump and were like, you know, here, sift through all this. You know. And from what I've seen of different reports that were condensed and written up by different organizations, it sounds like the prosecutor was leading and basically acting as a defense attorney for Wilson, because it's like, well, you feared for your life. Is that correct?
Well, that's another thing too. In grand juries is there's no cross examination. Only one side, only the state gets to give testimony.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, with talking to Randy, I asked if it was common for defendants to testify at the grand jury, and what he put down was, while it is not common for a defendant to testify in the grand jury, it is appropriate in some instances, one of which would be in the accidental or self-defense shooting situation. In that case, the subject will be, one, in a key position to say what happened, and two, is more likely to be willing to tell their side without taking the fifth.
All right, we'll be back with more of Freedom Fiends Distance Learning Law School. No, I'm kidding. When we get back from this trip to the radical capitalist market.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Meow, meow.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
All right. Yak.
Yak. All right. Lou's going to drop some mad scientists about grand juries. Go ahead, brother.
All right. Little review from before the break. With the grand jury, the defendant usually does not testify, but according to Randy England, Esquire, the Freedom Fiends legal counsel.
The chop shop attorney.
Yeah, the chop shop attorney. It may be appropriate in some cases where it was an accidental death or self-defense to go in there and say what happened. And he also mentions that it's likely that they'll be willing to tell their side without pleading the Fifth Amendment. However, a defendant does not have a right to testify in a grand jury. So the prosecutor can exclude them from going in there and telling their side. And with the grand jury being as one-sided as it is, with the Ferguson grand jury, and like, you know, none of us were in there, so we don't know exactly what happened. We can only go by the document dump and if some of the grand jurors choose to come forward and talk about it later, I'm not sure if they're even allowed to, but there were a lot of crazy things in there, such as leading the defendant, Darren Wilson, and basically soft-pedaling the whole thing. Also, my understanding is the assistant prosecutor had delivered a piece of law for the grand jurors to look at. Well, it was the law regarding shooting a fleeing suspect. And I believe somewhere in the 70s, they had passed a law saying that, yeah, you can do that. But in the early 80s, it was deemed unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States. So as I heard it reported, the prosecutor gave a piece of law to the grand jury that was deemed unconstitutional before she even started practicing law in the first place. And it said that they could shoot a fleeing suspect. And then later on, she retracted and says, oh, that's not the current law. Here's the current law. She didn't say that it got struck down by the Supreme Court as being unconstitutional.
There were show trials for the Salem witch. The Salem witch trials were show trials. And then the last thing that's generally considered to have actually been a show trial in America was in 1927, two Italian anarchists in America were accused of an armed robbery. Both were executed despite international appeals and widespread criticism of the evidence used to convict them. So witches and anarchists, that's the history of show trials. And now it's just everybody. Now it's just to protect cops when they murder people. And again, you know, I'm not picking a side on this thing with Wilson and the kid he shot. What was the kid's name?
The kid's name was Michael Brown.
Yeah.
And he is definitely an unsympathetic case.
Let's talk about the cigarette salesman in New York City. That's much more cut and dry. There's video and it's a very sympathetic case.
Okay. And we don't know what happened in the grand jury room because there's been no evidence dump or anything like that.
In the New York City case?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's a secret proceeding and the information generally isn't released. I think that the prosecutor did it in the Ferguson case just in hopes of satiating the masses, which, as we saw, did not work.
Yeah. Is there still unrest in Ferguson?
I really don't know. I haven't been checking the live streams too much lately.
Yeah. That's the kind of I would like to hear people go back and see what's up with things that were big in the news, you know, a year or two ago or 6 months ago or 6 years ago. I think that's something with that. There's a lot of people talk to me and say they want to start a podcast and ask my advice on it. And I think that'd be a great theme for a podcast. Like, you know, tyranny last year, tyranny before, you know, instead of just telling, there's a million podcasts, there's dozens of podcasts talking about what's happening that's horrible that's in the news today. I would love to see one that's devoted to actually doing some digging and following up on previous things that everyone was screeching about, rightfully so, in the past that they've completely forgotten about because there's more tyranny all the time. So if you want to start a podcast, there you go, man.
Yeah, but a lot of the tyranny from last year is still current events.
Yeah, but then people forget, too. Like that guy that's in prison for printing those silver medallions, man, Von Nothaus. That guy's serving like 8 years in prison, and I haven't heard any follow-ups on it. I'd like to hear an interview from jail from him.
He's getting out soon.
Oh, good. There you go. That's redemption in the third act of the first hour. We'll be back with hour two after this trip to the radical capitalist market on the Freedom Fiends. Worms. We're talking about show trials and the modern manifestation of them, which is the way grand juries are done in America now. So what did you say that Stalin, or was it Lenin, said about trials, Lou?
I believe it was Lenin, and the quote is, "Show me the man and I'll show you the crime."
And what does that mean?
It just means that you grab somebody up, you make an accusation. Maybe there's some evidence, maybe there's not. Maybe you just fabricate it. But the system goes on its own way, and somebody gets executed.
And governments like that. The prosecutors in America, and probably a lot of places, but in America definitely, they live and die. Their career lives and dies by their conviction rate.
Unless it's a cop.
What's that?
Unless they're prosecuting a cop.
Right, right. And then it's the opposite. So, you know, they like the fact that everyone commits three felonies a day without knowing about it. They love the fact that there's all these nanny laws against guns and drugs and what else do they do? All sorts of things. Oh, resisting.
Job security for them.
Resisting arrest. Yeah, things that, you know, that they make up. Yeah, resisting arrest, that crime. I mean, basically, resisting arrest means, you know, using a natural function of survival, like, you know, trying to evade capture or physical violence against you. So, but that's illegal.
Or not bowing down after the cuffs are put on you.
Yeah. So, Nick, can you read this description of show trials during the Soviet Union years?
Yeah. So this is Wikipedia, and it starts out with, "Show trials were a significant part of Joseph Stalin's regime. The Moscow trials of the Great Purge period, 1937 through 38, in the Soviet Union are the characteristic. The authorities staged the actual trials meticulously. If defendants refused to cooperate, i.e. to admit guilt for their alleged and mostly fabricated crimes, they did not go on public trial but suffered execution nonetheless. This happened, for example, during the prosecution of the so-called Labor Peasant Party, party invented by the NKVD, which in particular assigned the notable economist Alexander Chayanov to it." You have something?
I was just going to say that show trials are also called kangaroo courts, but go on.
Yeah. "Some solid public evidence of what really happened during the Moscow trials came to the West during the Dewey Commission. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, more information became available. This discredited Walter Duranty, who claimed that these trials were actually fair. According to a declassified Soviet archives in 1937 to 1938, the NKVD arrested more than 1.5 million people, of whom 681,692 were executed.
You know, another set of show trials in America, they weren't really trials, but they were in their effect, was Joseph McCarthy trying to rout out communists and, you know,
making, he failed.
Yeah, making people, he failed, making people testify, you know, before Congress. And the thing was, there wasn't really a, you know, a sentencing or a jury in that, but basically, if you got called before one of those committees, you instantly were unhirable and blacklisted, especially in Hollywood.
Yeah. I want to go back to the Russian show trials.
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing that they have this terrorist group called the Labor Peasant Party in the Workers' Paradise?
Yeah. It wasn't the official Labor Peasant Party, though. That's the problem.
Yeah. And Nick, have you learned about the Great Purge in school?
No, actually.
Okay. All right. Also from Wikipedia, the Great Purge was a campaign of political repression in the Soviet Union that was orchestrated by Joseph Stalin and occurred from 1934 to 1940. It involved a large-scale purge of the Communist Party and government officials. They killed their own. Repression of peasants and the Red Army leadership and widespread police surveillance, suspicion of saboteurs, imprisonment, and arbitrary executions. In Russian historiography, the period of the most intense purge, 1937-1938, is called a really long Russian name. After Nikolai Yeltsov, the head of the Soviet secret police, NKVD. During the course of the Soviet Union, there were probably about 60 million, maybe 1 or 2 million more people that were murdered by the government. The Great Purge wasn't the only purge. I mean, there were several purges. And Stalin was so paranoid that some other good communist might come up and unseat him in the future that he was actually taking out the good communists.
Well, think about that. You know, Nima Vedati has said, and I really like this phrase, that the radicals become the conservatives the day after the revolution. So there were these people who'd had their filthy communist revolution. And when I say filthy communists, I'm not speaking of the peasants that had no choice. I mean, this was put on them. I'm speaking of the government, basically. And today, anybody who wants to be a communist, I think, is filthy minded, at least. So,
yeah. And there's a differentiation because, like socialism, that comes from the ballot box, but communism comes from the barrel of a gun.
And yeah, but socialism comes from the ballot box backed with the barrel of a gun.
Yeah, but it's a kinder, gentler gun.
It's basically socialism is the illusion of democracy with communism. But I mean, the Soviet Union, one of those S's in USSR stood for Soviet or for socialist, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of the countries that are considered communist considered themselves socialist. It's just it's all on the same continuum.
Yeah, is murder versus assisted suicide, I think, would be a good differentiation.
Man, too soon.
Yeah. Yuri Maltsev, who's involved with the Mises Institute, was telling about when some KGB chief had gone on Russian TV after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and people were asking about how many people were murdered. And he says, well, 60 million, that sounds a little bit high. I don't really know. You know, let me go check the archives. And he came back on a week later and he says, oh, yeah, I knew it was bunk. We could only find 43 million documented murders.
Huh. Mm.
You know, 43 million documented.
It's looking to me like the term radical capitalism, which I just thought I made up, is actually another term for anarcho-capitalism. So I like it. I'm going to try it on and wear it for a few weeks. I'm a radical capitalist. It's a very, like, I would think a very off-putting term to, like, small government Republicans, because it's basically saying, I'm like you, but better at it. Radical capitalist.
You know what? There really are no small government Republicans.
Oh, I know.
Maybe Ron Paul, but
he was the only one. He was the only one in office, and a lot of his followers were like that too. But he's really the and I'm not saying, boy, if he'd been president, wouldn't things be different? You know, he's my favorite government thug, and the only government thug I've ever liked. But yeah, he was the only one that really played by the rules of the Constitution, you know, that really cared about it and really didn't make any exceptions in wartime or exceptions when it was his district or anything like that, you know?
Yeah, but something else, like with the rest of them, they all have one thing in common. They believe that government is good and that it can be used to do good. So with the growth of government under, you know, all these alleged small government Republicans, you know, government grows and they're kind of like somebody, you know, playing blackjack. You know, government grows and they're like, okay, go ahead, hit me. Go ahead, hit me. And, you know, it never gets big enough. And then all of a sudden, you know, you got something that looks like North Korea, but no time did they say, whoa, we should have stopped back at such and such.
Yeah.
No, they kept saying, hit me. Let's go. More.
Yeah.
They're like degenerate gamblers and they're $18 trillion in the hole.
Yeah, man. They just passed $18 trillion, didn't it?
Yep. Inconvenient truth is the national debt is constitutional.
When I was a kid, numbers, you know, that were in the trillions were never applied to economics. They were only applied to, like, you know, astrophysics.
Yeah, counting stars and their reflections.
Yeah, things like that. Stars and their reflections.
Yeah.
What's the reflection of a star look like?
I don't know. It's probably just like a star.
Oh, you know, I wanted to mention, we have been talking a lot for the past 3 years about our plan for Liberty, which is basically to be on radio, as many stations as possible, and, you know, help the people on Earth with that, with our message, but also mainly the satellite beam that goes up to the satellites that come, you know, from Genesis Communications Network, and then that comes down to the affiliates and they pick it up from there. That beam goes into space, and my plan is that the possibly habitable planet near Alpha Centauri, 4.3 light years away, will eventually hear it and say, oh, there's intelligent life on this planet, and come down and help the Freedom Fiends, either by giving us, you know, government shielding technology or allowing us to be guests in their libertarian paradise planet. And I was looking up, it was kind of interesting. I was looking out the window at stars one night from my windowless bunker, and I was thinking, like, can I see Alpha Centauri? And I did some Googling, like, how to see Alpha Centauri. You can see it with the naked eye from the southern hemisphere. So I know that we have some listeners in Australia. So Google how to view Alpha Centauri and look at it, and drop a comment on our site or send me an email. Better yet, send me a picture of it. I'd love a picture of one of our fans with Alpha Centauri in the background waving at it.
Do a selfie.
A selfie with the Alpha Centauri.
Yeah. I hear everybody in Somalia listens to us.
Do they? I hear a lot of people telling us to move to Somalia, but there's actually a bunch of people in around Ghana and what's the next country over in Africa that hear us on satellite, because we're on the LRNKU band satellite, and they don't have
Liberia.
They don't have internet access there. So I'm going to look it up, because they have listening parties, like 30 people go over to one guy's house and listen. So I want to do the right shout out to them.
All right. Hey, whoever that other country is besides Ghana, let us know. Drop us an email. talkback@freedomfiends.com.
Yeah, it's not Ghana. Well, Ghana, we do have some fans there, but they listen on the internet. But Ghana does, it borders Burkina Faso, which I remember in the Simpsons episode where Bart is calling phone numbers in the southern hemisphere and asking them to flush their toilet to find out if it really goes the opposite direction. And Homer,
the boot.
Homer gets the bill, the phone bill, and he's like, Burkina Faso, disputed zone. Who calls all these crazy places? We'll be back on the Freedom Fiends. Worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Bring us back, Lou. Bring us back, Lou. Bring us back, Lou.
Freedom Fiends. Tasing you with liberty and not tasing you with the other stuff.
Yeah.
This is Lusander Fiend, and I have Mr. Michael W. Dean. Oof. And Nick Hazelton, the hazy yak. You still there, Nick?
I'm here.
Okay.
Is it past your bedtime? Are you sleepy?
No, I've been staying up late recently.
Cool. What do you do when you stay up?
I do a lot of things. I work on homework. I try and get some editing done and listen to music.
Audio editing?
Yeah.
What music you listening to?
I've been listening to a lot of horrorcore rap.
Ah, I know that genre.
It's kind of like grunge. I thought of Bomb when I started listening to it.
It's nothing like Bomb.
No, it's very different, but
we were gentlemen.
It's got some similarities.
We were gentlemen. All right, so Lou, you found a horrifying article that's kind of funny at the same time. Now that's the kind of horrorcore that I like, is like so hilarious it hurts. Go ahead.
Okay, now I'm just looking at it for the first time, so I might be a little bit on it. The headline is, prosecutors say 1789 George Washington law requires Google and Apple to decrypt smartphones for cops. Oh, man. And this is on BenSwan.com. Okay. All right, first paragraph. Ever since whistleblower Edward Snowden revealed that the National Security Agency has been spying on Americans' private digital communications in a widespread, warrantless, and indiscriminate manner, technology companies like Google and Apple have begun to respond to consumer demand for anti-government snoop prevention tools by developing smartphones that come with unbeatable security measures that prevent anyone other than the phone's owner from unlocking it and accessing its data. As courts wrestle with the question of whether judges can order cell phone companies to help cops gain access to suspects' smartphone data, tech giants are stepping out in front of the issue by developing smartphones and tablets that they themselves cannot even unlock. In response to mobile technology companies' self-interested attempts to protect users' privacy, according to Ars Technica, federal prosecutors have successfully argued two times so far that an obscure catch-all signed in 1789 by George Washington during his first year in office requires tech firms to assist the government in obtaining suspects' private smartphone and tablet data. All Writs Act, which first made its way into federal statute as a part of the Judiciary Act of 1789, and which was later tweaked into its current form in 1911, grants federal courts the power to issue all writs necessary or appropriate in aid of their respective jurisdictions and agreeable to the usages and principles of law. The above provided video by a cybersecurity fellow at Center for International Security and Cooperation, Jonathan Mayer, breaks down the logic that prosecutors might use when arguing that the All Writs Act could be utilized to compel a tech company to unlock a phone or decrypt its data on behalf of the government.
I don't even understand what that said. Not that it's all that. It's not techie. It's not the problem I have with it. It's the law part of it just basically sounds to me like there's an old law from the Whiskey Rebellion that says you must tell the constable what he asks you. Am I hearing that correctly?
Well, it's before the Whiskey Rebellion, but I think the key word was catch all.
But isn't that also before the Bill of Rights?
Yeah, it would be because the magic parchment was ratified in 1789 and the Bill of Rights wasn't ratified until 1791.
Yeah, so wouldn't that, don't later laws undo earlier laws if they contradict them?
Well, in theory.
Yeah. Police haven't figured that out yet. They'll make someone spend a lot of money on attorneys to point that out in a court of law, and it still may not work.
Well, I believe Plato put it pretty good when he said, good people don't need laws for them to behave, and bad people will just ignore them.
Yeah, man.
And by bad people, he meant government.
Man, there have been a bunch of police killings lately. No charges for cop who killed 19-year-old preschool teacher as she drove away from party. Police say tasering 8-year-old Native American girl was justified. Here's a good one. The only CIA officer in prison for the torture program is the whistleblower who exposed it.
Oh, man. Well, the only person in jail for the collateral murder incident is Bradley Manning for exposing it too.
Yep. Man, governments don't like the sunshine of the light of day and truth pointing at them at all.
Yeah. Whistleblowers only give aid and comfort to the enemy when they remain silent.
Yeah. We'll be back on the Freedom Fiends.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
And we're live. Take it, Nick. Take it.
Hey, this is Nick Hazelton, the anarcho-yacatalist. I'm here with Lusander Fien and Michael Dean. This is the Freedom Fiends.
Yeah. All right. And?
We are talking about... I forgot my space. Okay. It's late.
Lou, what are we talking about?
All right. I figure... what they probably did with that 1789 George Washington law was just like over in East Germany, the Stasi is able to open up your mail and read it, and that's what they use as their justification. So you had a bunch of guys with powdered wigs and steam kettles opening up letters.
They probably got powder in the envelopes from their wigs.
Yeah, but I don't know. I wasn't able to watch the video, so. I can't say exactly what it is. Maybe I'll get a chance to watch it in the next break.
But they didn't yet know what powdered anthrax was. But anthrax was pretty common. Didn't it kill sheep back then?
Yeah. Well, it is powdered, I believe, and you will find it in the on the farms in the droppings. Yeah, that's a proper word for it.
You know, when I was a kid, Americans talked about how we were superior to the East Germans and the Soviets.
Funny, so did they.
And say things like, well, they read people's mail without a warrant. And now that happens all the time here now. And there's a meme.
I think it always did.
There's a meme going around that is based on something I said, or else somebody came up with it independent of me. And it's that Richard Nixon was rightfully deposed as president for bugging one hotel room. You know, Bush and Obama are bugging the entire country and no one cares.
Yeah. And Bush already has a library and Obama will get a library too.
Yeah. Ugh. Maybe he'll get all libraries. Maybe President Hillary's first act as president will be to rename every library after Obama.
And burn all the books.
Burn all the books that have anything about liberty in them. All right, so you wanted to talk about something. What was it, Lou?
Oh, okay. Yeah, going back to the whole Eric Garner thing, a little side note on that.
Who's Eric Garner? Say it again.
Okay, Eric Garner is the fellow in New York City that was killed by the cops. There's a very good article by Jack Perry, and it's on lourockwell.com. It's called Small Businessman Murdered by Tax Enforcers.
Yeah.
An excerpt of it is, he is dead because he was suspected of daring to sell a legal product without charging his customers an outrageously high cigarette sales tax the state demands. He died because in the eyes of the state, he questioned their authority to enforce tyrannical laws. The darkly ironic thing is, liberals are protesting the death of Eric Garner, but liberals are the reason Eric Garner is dead.
Yeah.
Liberals are the ones who called for sales taxes of several dollars per pack on cigarettes.
That's a really good point that I hadn't really considered that cut and dry. It is that cut and dry, man. And whenever people say, you know, they want to put a sin tax on cigarettes, or they want to, you know, legalize but regulate and tax marijuana, they're putting people in jail and they're murdering people by doing that.
Yeah. Well, Murray Rothbard hit the nail on the head with the sin taxes. He said, sin taxes do not increase revenue or decrease bad behavior. They encourage smuggling. And if you do the Forrest Gump version of history on this, Forrest Gump would say, the city of New York, they were just minding their own business, taxing the living daylights out of stuff. And for no reason whatsoever, black markets started popping up.
Yeah. And the reason they don't actually raise the money, you know, add any money to the state, is the extra money they raise goes to extra enforcement. You know, it's pretty much a net gain, a net loss, and people die.
And I was listening to an excerpt from Josh Talley. He's on GCN also.
Yeah, I like some of his stuff.
Yeah, he has a wonderful beard.
Yeah.
And he has some pretty good stuff. A very entertaining show.
He almost gets it. We're gonna drag him kicking and screaming to being a full on no government man one of these days.
Yeah, it probably wouldn't take too much.
I do like him. I want to say that. I like him.
Yeah, me too. He was talking to some retired statocrat, Department of Cigarettes and fun stuff.
Yeah.
And it may have been before or right after the whole Garner thing happened. And they were talking about how high the taxes were. And God bless Josh, because he has like the patience of a saint. The statocrat from the Department of Cigarettes and Stealing Money was saying, well, we just need to have more enforcement on this because, you know, people are, you know, they're black marketing it. And Josh is trying to explain to him the high taxes are the reason that there's a black market. It's just like the war on drugs, a.k.a. no cartel or police agency left behind. The prohibition or the high tax creates an illicit market and it screws everything up. But these filthy statists have this idea that, oh, gee, let me just write something down on paper and it will magically appear.
Yeah. You
know, I'm going to write down that healthcare becomes cheap and abundant and then poof, you know, it's appeal to unicorns.
Yeah. Appeal to unicorns. That should be the name of a new name for that.
Logical fallacy.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah,
appeal to unicorns.
Your logical fallacy is government, but I mean it's really simple. When prices go up on something, or you know, if people are on a budget, they're going to shop around. People don't want to get their pants pulled down over the price of something, so they're going to go buy it elsewhere. In New York City, cigarettes are $15 a pack. When I drove through New York State in June to go to Pork Fest, the state minimum pricing was $9.83. But you can go to any of the neighboring states and get a lower price. You can even go to the Indian reservations and get them between $20 and $30 a carton.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's just a little bit more for 10 packs than it is for one pack in New York City. So they have this idea that people are going to say, oh, well, gee, they made this law, therefore I must spend extra money. No, it doesn't work that way. You know, liberals might vote to raise taxes. It doesn't mean they want to pay them. So here we have a dead guy because people say, oh, yeah, we need taxes. Now, Garner has come under an awful lot of fire, and people have said, well, he's been arrested 31 times. Yeah, he has been harassed 31 times in the past. But Mr. Pantaleo, the murdering officer, is not exactly squeaky clean himself. Let's see now. Darren Collins and Tommy Rice alleged in a 2013 federal court lawsuit that Pantaleo and at least four other officers subjected them to humiliating and unlawful strip searches in public view after handcuffing them during a March 2012 arrest on Staten Island. The court complaint charged that the cops, searching for illegal drugs, pulled down the plaintiff's pants and underwear and touched and searched their genital areas. Maybe they want to work for TSA or stood by while this was done in their presence. And let's see. I believe the case was settled for, I think, $60,000. I'm not seeing it in this particular article.
I'm looking at the Josh Tolley website, and there's a link to something on Blacklisted News on there about Oregon schools handing out pamphlets to 11-year-olds, teaching them how to have sex and do crystal meth to prolong their sexual experiences. Nick, you're in an Oregon public school. Are you receiving that pamphlet also?
I am not.
Yeah,
he's 16. He already knows how to do crystal meth.
That's horrible.
This is too soon.
Pretty bizarre. Yeah. Yeah. And it's weird. It's like, I feel weird even asking Nick that, but apparently they're teaching that in school there. So I just want to know if that was in all Oregon schools.
No, that was a pretty crazy story. I saw that on the news.
Yeah. You saw it on TV?
Yeah, I saw a little bit of it. And then I looked it up and it was very weird. They had a conference that they were sending these kids to, and it was very explicit and pornographic even.
Wow.
It's actually kind of disgusting.
Yeah. I don't approve.
No.
No.
It was like, it was younger kids than I am. These are middle schoolers. So it's,
yeah. And also, it, you know, it's like they didn't know what they were going to be exposed to, and their parents didn't. It just happened when they were there. It just got sprung on them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Schools. Yeah. They don't teach you like life skills, though. They just teach you things about identity and who you are and how to find yourself and how to do crystal meth, I guess.
Well, they teach life skills. They'll teach kids how to vote for their supper.
Yeah. They actually, in some schools, teach you how to fill out welfare forms and unemployment forms. But I don't want to start sounding like one of them conservative radio shows complaining about, think of the children. You know, the answer isn't to take that out of the schools. It's to remove the school, the public schools. And then people can have their kids educated however they want. Would you guys agree?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no more reforms. The reformers want to do everything but actually solve the problem.
Let's ask Nick, who's actually in school, rather than telling him what should be done with his education. What do you think, Nick?
I do get some benefits out of being in school.
Yeah, well, your dad's the principal.
Yeah. So there are some things, but
you would meet girls outside of school,
which would be a lot nicer. It's not fun to date girls within a small school.
When your dad's the principal?
Well, yeah, there's like 15 kids in my class. And I don't want to be I'm stuck with all of those people. I'd rather not be.
Does your dad say if you mess up that it'll go down on your permanent record?
He has not threatened that yet, but
I like how they used to threaten me with that. Did they threaten you with that, Nick? I mean, Lou?
No. I was somewhat well behaved in high school.
I was well behaved, but I couldn't really sit in one place. I just missed the cutoff for being drugged. You know, I graduated from school in like 82, and that's when they were starting to drug people, you know, so I missed that by, I was lucky. But, yeah, they used to threaten that things would go on my permanent record. And I imagined this like folder of doom somewhere, and then I thought it was really funny when I saw on The Simpsons Bart being threatened with that permanent record thing, and Principal Skinner like waving this thick folder of offenses at him, and he said that he was trying to get Bart to do something, and he was offering a trade of he would burn Bart's permanent record, and he said that Bart's permanent record would bar him from all but the noisiest and hottest jobs.
Or here's one for you. Just imagine that you're up at the pearly gates meeting St. Peter, and he goes into the file cabinet, and he pulls out the permanent record from school, and then the principal comes out and says, "You have a lot to answer for, young man."
Yeah, that's what it reminded me of, was that permanent record book of life Bible thing, which I don't even know if that's in the Bible, at least not the way it's described. I could be wrong. It's been a long time since I've read the Bible. We'll be back on the Freedom Fiends after this trip to the radical capitalist free market.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
I guess in public schools in Oregon, they are advocating crystal meth in vending machines for middle schoolers, but they're not privately owned and operated, so I'm against it. I'm against it, man. So I want to talk about watches for some reason. I saw an ad today for some really fancy watch, you know, not a digital watch, a mechanical watch with hands that tick. And the ad looked like something from the 70s. I mean, it had like satellites and space and computers, and it looked like a brave new watch. And I'm like, it's just a watch. It's a watch that that automatically updates time zone when you travel with GPS, you know, so it's kind of an old meets new watch. And I'm thinking, like, who needs that? Everyone carries a device in their pocket that automatically does that anyway. You know, everybody's cell phone does that anyway. And I didn't really get it. And I was starting to think about the last time I owned a watch. I think I was about 16. And I think it was the only watch I ever had, and I had it for a couple months and then got tired of wearing it. I had a pocket watch for a while when I was about 25, but it was just, I thought it looked cool, but it really looked dorky pulling out a pocket watch. But I was realizing, like, I don't really, most of my life I structured in such a way that I didn't need a watch. until I got on radio, and now I need an accuracy of time that's not met by a watch. So I need to have atomic radio clocks on my walls. But do you guys wear watches?
I don't wear a watch because I ain't got time for that.
Nick?
No, I don't. I used to when I was, and I don't know when I how old I was, but no, I stopped. It broke, and I just never got a new one.
Yeah.
It's been a few years. I had a couple that broke. And I mean, with cell phones now, you could just reach in your pocket, pull out the cell phone, see what time it is. Or, you know, I have my atomic clock right in front of my microphone. So
I've always kind of felt like watches are kind of square. Like, oh, you got places to be. You know, to me, like having places to be where you have to be there at a certain time kind of implies like you're working for the man. You know, and I'm not decrying anyone who has a job. I think everyone should have a job, but who can, you know? But yeah, I've always tried to structure my life in such a way that I didn't have to be anywhere at a certain time. And I've lived that life since 2001. I haven't had a day job since 2001. And it's a hard work, man. You have to work harder to make the same amount of money being self-employed. But I just didn't like it. And I've always naturally been on a time schedule. When left to my own devices, I'm on a time schedule where I'm up all night and go to sleep around dawn or maybe an hour or two before. And it's pretty hard to have any kind of meaningful job other than night watchman, having that kind of schedule. And I also kind of like taking naps. I've been taking naps almost every day since I was about 30. I think I started taking them. Do you guys nap when you can?
Yeah, sometimes.
And, you know, people might be tuning in and saying, like, what are they talking about? What does this have to do with freedom? Everything, man. This has everything to do with freedom. You know, you could talk about how the government's spying on you and how you want to vote at it and try to change it. But really, the best thing you can do, I think, is find ways to increase your freedom in your life. And what bigger freedom is there than not being on someone else's timetable? That's what I think.
Or even taking advantage of the simple joys. When it comes to naps, I do have one particular favorite nap, and it's taking a nap on a Sunday afternoon when it's raining really hard.
Oh, yeah. I like when it rains really hard because the kids next door aren't playing in the backyard waking me up.
Yeah, but it's a gentle sound of the rain hitting the windows and the roof and everything else. Or if you have the windows open, you can listen to it coming down. It's just very calm and peaceful. And that's, you know, a little slice of heaven that you can get in spite of the state.
I like that. My favorite kind of nap is a burrito nap. It's where you eat a burrito or some other kind of like really heavy, carb heavy, meat heavy, protein heavy food. And then you just go to sleep. It's almost like taking a Valium or something. You're out. How about you, Nick? What's your favorite kind of nap, Nick?
The only time I take naps, and I usually don't, is when I'm coming on with you guys. But otherwise, I don't nap.
When you're coming on with us guys. It sounded like you said coming home with you guys. I wanted to clarify that's not what you said.
No, yeah.
I've never met Nick.
Yeah. Now, I used to go to bed around dawn, but then I started dating Marie.
That's an old people joke. Nick doesn't get that one.
No, I don't.
Yeah. Dawn and Marie. All right. It's been a great show, guys.
Yeah. Worms.
Worms.
It was truly a pleasure being had again.
It's been nice having you. Worms.